Matthew chapter 18. I'd like for us to look at a text as we begin our lesson here this morning. We certainly appreciate your presence here today. It's a beautiful day outside, and it's good to be with God's people today as we worship Him in spirit and in truth. We'd encourage you to be back with us again tonight. Also, I neglected to mention to Kim, we are going to resume the character study lessons that we are doing on the last Monday of each month. That will be the 26th of this month, and we'll be looking at Joshua. And we'd like to encourage everyone who's able to come, and we'll have it here at the building again at 7 o'clock. That'll be on the 26th. I think I put the 24th on the scroll, but I'll change that this evening. So if you're able to be here for that. And also, I believe tonight, I haven't confirmed this with Phil, but I think the Midland High School study will be at his house tonight. He nodded, so that's his approval. So if you're able to be there, any who are in middle or high school, we'd encourage you to be here for that. Matthew chapter 18, I'd like us to begin by looking at the first 9 verses, Matthew chapter 18. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And Jesus called a little child to him, set him in the midst of them, and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes. If your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life lame or maimed, rather than having 2 hands or 2 feet to be cast into the everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life with 1 eye rather than having 2 eyes to be cast into hellfire." I'd like you to notice in this text, as Jesus talks about the humility and accepting nature of children, he teaches as well some attitudes that we must adopt if, in fact, we are to see heaven. Here we see that we are to become like little children. Verse 5, you'll notice the idea is expressed that if we receive a child in the name of Christ, it is in essence as if we receive Christ. Notice in verse 6, it warns there of causing one in such a state of innocence to sin. This morning, I'd like for us for a few moments to focus a little bit on this idea that is expressed in this text about causing another to sin. And we begin by asking the question, exactly how is it that one person can cause another person to sin? On one level, I think we must recognize, if you turn over to the book of James, that really sin is a very personal thing. There is one sense in which I cannot sin unless I deliberately choose to involve myself in something which is sinful. James points this out to us in James chapter 1, beginning in verse 13 and going down to verse 15. It says, "Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desire and enticed. Then when desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." You see there, it is something that comes from our own initiative, from our own will, our own desire, our own choice. It is personal in nature. In fact, if you look back in the Old Testament book of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel chapter 18 and verse 20, we see that it's a mistake for us to play the blame game and to say, well, it's my parents' fault or it's my children's fault or it's someone else's fault that I have done something that's wrong. In Ezekiel chapter 18 and verse 20, the Lord makes it very clear. We each individually stand before God accountable for our own sin. We read this in particular in Ezekiel chapter 18 and verse 20, which says, "The soul who sins shall die. The son shall not bear the guilt of the father, nor the father bear the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself." What a powerful passage that refutes that idea that so many in the religious world hold that because Adam sinned, we're guilty of sin. No, that's not right. We are individually guilty of sin when we choose to engage in that which is sinful. But what then is it talking about here in Matthew chapter 18 when it describes the idea of causing another to sin? We might compare it, if you look back in the book of Nehemiah, in Nehemiah chapter 13, the idea seems to be that rather than actually causing another or making them or forcing them, we can, by our influence, act in such a way that we lead another person to sin. In Nehemiah chapter 13, we see this as we look at this book that comes at the end of the exile, when in fact they are returning back to the land of Israel. And one of the problems that they encountered when many of the Jews who had been in exile returned back to the land of Palestine, the land of Israel, they learned that there were some among the people who had remained who had intermarried with those of the nations around them. Now, if one had converted to Judaism, that would not have been a problem. But the law made it very clear that under the old law, Jews were not to marry those that were outside of the covenant of Israel, those who had not converted to Judaism. And in this text, in Nehemiah chapter 13, verses 23 through 26, I'd like us to read together something which addresses this very idea of how it can be that the action of one person can be described as causing another person to sin. Let's look at this. Nehemiah 13, beginning in verse 23. "In those days, I also saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. So I contended with them, and cursed them, and struck some of them, and pulled out their hair, and made them swear by God, saying, 'You shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves.'" Now notice, "Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things?" Remember, Solomon had sinned to the utmost in taking all sorts of different wives of other nations. That's what's addressed here. "Yet among many nations, there was no king like him who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over Israel." Listen to this. "Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin." And what's meant by that? You'll remember that Solomon, in all of the multiple wives that he took, many of which were pagan wives, Solomon, who had built the temple of God in Israel, was so influenced and so corrupted by the influence of these pagan wives that he took. Did you know that Solomon even constructed in the city of Jerusalem shrines to worship other gods? That's what Matthew chapter 18 is talking about. The sense to which one can cause another to sin. We can't act in such a way that we influence someone else to sin. We make it easier for them to sin, or we make it harder for them to do that which is right. In our text in Matthew chapter 18, there are a couple of words I'd like to call to your attention. The first word that in the New King James is translated "cause to sin" is the Greek word skandalizo. It is a verb. The noun is also used in this text that the New King James translates offense. I think the Old King James would use the term offense for both words. And here the noun skandalon, you know, you can tell just from the way it sounds, we get our word scandal or scandalize from this. What exactly do these words mean? They are used a number of times here in Matthew chapter 18. And it's interesting because when we look at the background of this word that we find in Matthew chapter 18, the verb and the noun form, originally it was used to refer to the stick that was placed in a trap. I don't know if any of you all like to watch these shows that are on Discovery Channel, Survivor Man or Man vs. Wild. One of the things that they're always trying to do is when they're out and they're trying to somehow catch some animal that they can live on, they'll construct one of these traps that either will be a rock or stone or something with a stick that when it's knocked out, that will entrap or that will kill the animal that's underneath it. Originally, that's what this referred to, that stick that was a part of a trap. But as time went on, we'll see in the Greek Old Testament, this word is not used in this place, but it carries that same sort of idea, the sense of laying a snare. In Psalm 38, verse 12, where David will speak of, they lay a snare for me. But the noun is used in the Greek Old Testament in Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 14 of a stumbling stone. There is a law that's set in place that you're not to put a stumbling stone before one who's blind. What a cruel thing that would be. Someone who cannot see their way and for a joke or for some cruel trick to put a stumbling stone in front of them. Here we see the very term used there. In the New Testament, we'll see that it is used in a few different ways. It will be used in reference to temptation to sin. It will be used in reference to a hindrance to one in doing that which is right. It will be used in reference to causing another person to fall. That idea of kind of a stumbling block or a stumbling stone. And in fact, in one instance, it is used of that which is simply repulsive. We'll see that these two words are used four times in Matthew chapter 18. I'd like us to think a little bit about something, some things that are said, in particular in verse 7 of Matthew chapter 18. Notice right at the beginning it says, "Woe to the world because of offenses." Notice this idea of that which causes someone to sin, that which influences someone in such a way as to make them sin. I think we need to understand to begin with that God is not pleased with those kinds of things that can come into our lives that will cause another to sin. Look over in Matthew chapter 13 with me for a moment. Matthew chapter 13. It's very easy for us to sometimes think, well, every man for himself. You know, sin is a personal thing. If you sin, it's your own problem. I don't have anything to do with that. We need to understand that as those who in many ways are to understand that we are our brother's keeper, we do have a responsibility to one another, that we never lay before one another that which can cause or influence someone in a direction that they ought not to go, or that can hinder them from doing those things that they ought to do. Notice here in Matthew chapter 13, verse 40 through 42, it says, "Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age." Jesus has told a parable about a field in which an enemy sowed weeds or tares. And I want you to see what he says about this. Verse 41, "The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things," notice, "that offend and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth." We observed in our Wednesday night class that our relationship with God is not something in which we are acceptable to Him if we just sit back and we don't do anything that violates the will of God. There are those things that we are obligated to do which are proactive. We must do those things that are active in nature. Here I want you to notice that in much the same way, it is not going to be that we are acceptable before God as long as we sit back and we have guarded ourselves and we've never done anything that we that causes us to stumble into sin, but we disregard the kind of influence we might have had on others. Here I want you to notice in verse 41 that the Lord is describing drawing out of His kingdom, describing His angels, taking out that which offends. All things that offend. If I've lived my life in such a way that I may have done those things that are right in and of myself, but I've disregarded the kind of influence that I might have had on others by my attitude or my actions or even liberties that I might have engaged in, and somehow I have influenced someone else to sin, I may well be considered one of those things that offends. We must recognize, if you look over in Romans chapter 1, that God's wrath is revealed against such. There's a text in Romans chapter 1 in which the Apostle Paul begins a three-chapter section in which he's going to talk about the seriousness of sin. And he sets this up with a powerful verse in Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. where he puts it this way: "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men." Notice what they do, of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Now, what does it mean when it says suppress the truth in unrighteousness? Is that not the same as describing a hindrance to doing that which is true, that which is right? Is that not the same thing that we're talking about here? If we have acted in such a way, if we are suppressing truth, we are acting in such a way that hinders others from doing that which is right, God's wrath is revealed against such. Notice another element of Matthew chapter 18 and verse 7. It describes the fact that offenses must come. Offenses must come. In other words, we cannot live our lives in such a way that we will be totally immune from, or we can in some way escape all temptation or all kinds of things that might put a trial before us. Look over in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. We glanced at this a little bit in our adult class this morning, but I want us to focus on one element of it. You'll remember 1 Corinthians chapter 5 addresses this matter of congregational discipline. What a horrible circumstance had come into the church in Corinth. There had been one who was a member of the congregation who actually had taken his father's wife for himself. And Paul urges their congregational discipline. They're to withdraw from such a one. But in the course of talking about this one, I want you to notice something that said, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9 and 10. "I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. Yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or with covetous, or extortioners, or idolaters." Notice, "since then you would need to go out of the world." If we were going to somehow imagine that we could as Christians live our lives in such a way that we never face any sort of temptation, the only way that that could happen, and we're talking theoretically here, but the only way, as Paul describes it, is we'd have to go out of the world. That's not possible, is it? It is not something in which we can remove ourselves from the world. Even those who have tried, whether we're talking about monks or whether we're talking about even Amish and Mennonites that just simply try to remove themselves, they're not in a situation in which they're totally immune from any kind of temptation. And in the same way, we're not going to have the influence on the world that we ought to if we come out of the world. We need to understand as well that with respect to the difficulties that we face in this life, Jesus said that we are in a circumstance and a situation in which we are not called to come to Christ and view it as if we have no temptation, we have no hardship. Rather, we are to look to the one who has overcome such things. Look at John chapter 16 and verse 33. Jesus says, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." So we can't live in such a way that we won't have any offense, any cause of stumbling. But what are we to do? What is to be the attitude we must have towards such things? Are we to embrace them? Are we to treat them as if they're insignificant? No, the Bible makes it very clear that we are to flee from these things. No, we can't go out of the world, but when we see those things that are temptation, when we see those things that are an offense, when we see those things in our own life that might cause another to be influenced to sin, we're to flee from those things. Let me throw out a few examples for you. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18. There, Paul tells the Corinthians to flee from sexual immorality. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 14. There in the same epistle, he tells the Corinthians to flee from idolatry. Now, we might think of that and say, well, you know, we don't have a problem with that today. Well, you go a few pages over in your Bible to the book of Colossians, and you'll see in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5 that there the Apostle Paul equates covetousness with idolatry. Do we have a problem with covetousness? Absolutely, we struggle with covetousness. We're to flee from it. We're to flee from those things which could lead to covetousness. Finally, 2 Timothy chapter 2, Verse 22 there teaches we are to flee from youthful lusts, those things that the young, the inexperienced, the immature might struggle with. What are we to do with temptation? We run away from it. We flee from it. We don't act as if we're immune to it. We don't act as if it's insignificant. We flee from it. One last thing in verse 7 of Matthew chapter 18. Notice it says, woe to that man by whom the offense comes. You know, Jesus began by saying woe to the world because of offenses. And we looked at the fact that offenses must come. We can't remove ourselves from it. But in our lesson this morning, we're particularly focusing on that degree to which we may have some influence in that area. Woe to that man by whom the offense comes. I think Jesus makes it very clear here that we absolutely must not be the occasion for stumbling, the hindrance from doing good, the influence towards sin in the lives of another person. Now, you may say, well, that's right. We should not do that. But I want us to think for a moment, how exactly could it be that we could do that? Well, I think the obvious is that we could do it just simply by direct temptation to sin. Over in the book of Revelation, in Revelation chapter 2, in one of these brief letters to the seven churches in Asia, I think we see a pretty clear-cut example of instances in which there is direct temptation to sin. We don't know a lot of the details, but look at what it says here in this epistle in which to the church in Pergamos. Notice verse 14. But I have a few things against you, because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel. Now, we don't know exactly what this is referring to. You'll remember that Balaam, all the way back when the children of Israel came out of Egypt and in their wanderings, Balaam was an Old Testament prophet that actually had been hired to try to cause the Israelites to stumble, to prophesy against them. Now, initially, he doesn't do that, but then later, he lays a stumbling block before them to lead them into sexual immorality. Now, it's not likely here that there is some direct relationship. I imagine what's being described here is whoever it was in Pergamum that was tempting them, it was the same sort of thing. They were doing exactly what Balaam had done, and they were leading these people to accept sexual immorality. Notice, he taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit sexual immorality. You know, it's not very difficult. If we decided that we wanted to engage in sin, it's not very difficult to find avenues to pursue sin. And then it's not very difficult to offer that temptation to our brothers and sisters in Christ. Now, hopefully, we are of a nature that that's not what we struggle with. Hopefully, we will not knowingly and consciously give ourselves back to the world and then try to induce our brothers and our sisters to go with us back into that same muck and mire of sin. But that's one way it could be done. But it could as well be that by our actions, we simply act in such a way that we hinder others from doing right. Look over in Matthew chapter 16. Matthew chapter 16. I call your attention or recollection to this event that's described in Matthew chapter 16, verses 21 through 23. When Jesus begins to talk about what's going to happen to him very soon, he would go and he would die for the sins of mankind. I can sympathize with Peter, because if I had been there, I certainly would not have liked hearing the fact that my master was going to go to the cross and was going to die. And in my very carnal way of thinking, I might well have thought that's not what ought to happen. That's not what should happen, Lord. Let's read what's described here. Verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and raised the third day. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you. Now, stop there for just a moment and think about this.
Peter may well have acted with good intention. You and I might well have done exactly the same thing. But I want you to listen to what Jesus says about what resulted from that. What really was going on with this statement that Peter made. Verse 23. But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are an offense." Notice, "you are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." Now, was it that Peter was saying, "Lord, you know, here's these sinful things. Let's go. Let's go partying tonight. Let's go do that." No, that wasn't what he was doing. But he was simply laying before Jesus something which would hinder him from doing that which was right. And so it became an offense, a cause of stumbling, a hindrance from doing that which is right. Now, I think it's pretty evident, as we've noticed so far, that this is something that we, as those who are serving the Lord, as those who are disciples of Jesus Christ, must take seriously. And I want us to think, as we bring our lesson to a close, to what degree should we go to make certain in our own lives that we do not become a hindrance from doing right, or a cause of stumbling to a brother or a sister, or even to those in the world that we might hope to try to influence to be obedient to the gospel of Jesus Christ? I want you to go back to Matthew chapter 18 with me for a moment, and I want you to notice what the Lord said about this, and I want us to think about this for a moment. Down in verses 8 and 9, in the context in which he's been talking here about causing one of these little ones who believe in him, one of these children, to sin. Verse 8, "If your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life lame or maimed rather than having two hands or two feet to be cast into the everlasting fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. It is better for you to enter into life with one eye rather than having two eyes to be cast into hellfire." I want you to notice here, if you'll go back to when we read the initial reading back from verse 1, you'll notice that there is a shift in subject and voice here. Because initially he's been talking about the innocence of these little ones and warning against the one who would cause such a one to stumble, who would cause them to sin. But the shift comes in the fact that here it's not simply warning about causing another to sin, but here it's actually warning that you must not be such a one who is causing to sin, causing another to sin, and thus causing yourself to sin in the process. Notice what's described here. In order to avoid such, he says it would be better to cut off a hand or a foot or to pluck an eye from your head. Is he literally talking about actually dismemberment here or cutting off parts of your body? You know, the same language is used in Matthew chapter 5, there, verse 29 and 30, in the context of talking about looking at a woman to lust after her, uses the very same language. There was an early church father named Origen that took this very literally. And Origen actually had his private members cut off of his body so that he would not be confronted with such lust. Is that what this is talking about? I don't think necessarily we're talking about literally severing parts of our body. But I think instead the point is that we must have a willingness to give up whatever it is that causes sin in our own lives. Whatever it is that might influence or cause another to sin. You know, we looked recently in our study in Romans at some things that we see both in 1 Corinthians and in Romans 14. Go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 for a moment. And I want us to look, by way of analogy, at something that would have been a difficulty in the first century. In Corinth and in Rome, they had a similar problem related to the eating of meats, although the problem came from a different motive or a different background, if you will. Those who were in Corinth, most likely having come out of a Gentile background, would have come from a perspective in which at one point they would have eaten certain meats that had been sacrificed to idols, and they would have eaten those things as an act of worship to an idol. Those in Rome, many of whom seem to have come out of a Jewish background, they would have at one point believed that there were certain kinds of meats they could not eat because it had been prohibited in the law of Moses. Now, when in fact the gospel comes and those dietary restrictions are no longer in place, when in fact the gospel comes and it's clear that there's no God but one, what in fact do you do when it comes to the matter of eating meats? I want you to notice here in Corinth, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, read with me verse 25 down through verse 29. Notice, for whatever is sold, eat whatever is sold in the meat market, asking no questions for conscience sake. For the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. If any one of those who do not believe invites you to dinner and you desire to go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no question for conscience sake. But if anyone says to you, this was offered to idols, do not eat it for the sake of the one who told you, and for conscience sake. For the earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. Conscience, I say, not your own, but that of the other. For why is your liberty judged by another man's conscience? Now think about that for just a moment. And I want you to think of this in real terms. Have you ever, had a nice big juicy steak that's just been prepared just perfect on the grill? And I want you to imagine that you've gone over to this Gentile's house and you're sitting down and they've cooked that nice juicy steak, that you know there's nothing wrong with eating that steak. You know that that would just taste wonderful. And that says, here, eat this. This was sacrificed to Jupiter. Now, I want you to notice what Paul says. For the conscience of that individual, though you have the liberty to eat that juicy steak, you are willing to forego that because you don't want to do anything that might make that Gentile that you're eating with think, well, brother so-and-so is, they're worshiping Jupiter as well. Now think about it in a different light. Look over in Romans chapter 14. Romans chapter 14. Remember, the problem's slightly different. Those from a Jewish background, should you eat certain kinds of meat that the law prohibited or not? Under Christ, those prohibitions are no longer in place. But maybe you're a new convert. Maybe you have not yet come to really understand all of that. Let's look in Romans chapter 14, beginning verse 19. Therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace and the things by which one may edify another. Do not destroy the work of God for the sake of food. All things indeed are pure, but it is evil for the man who eats with offense. It is good neither to eat meat nor drink wine, nor do anything by which your brother stumbles or is offended or is made weak. Do you have faith? Have it yourself before God. Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves. But he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he does not eat from faith. For whatever is not from faith is sin. Now notice here, a similar kind of danger, but here, as you're dealing with the young Christian that might think, well, I've never been able to eat shellfish. I've never been able to eat pork. How could it be that I could do this? Is your attitude to be such that I'm in Christ now, I've got liberty, I can eat all the pork I want, I can eat all the shellfish I want? Is that to be the attitude and you just run right over that new convert? No. You are not to value these things that are liberties to such an extent that you disregard the influence you might have upon others. Basically, what we're talking about is we must have a willingness to give up, to abandon anything. Look in the same chapter here, Romans chapter 14, verse 12 and 13. Notice it says, so then each of us shall give account of himself to God. Therefore, let us not judge one another anymore, but rather resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in our brother's way. Now, we're talking about those things that are our liberty to do or not to do. We're not talking about those things that are sinful. Obviously, we shouldn't do those to begin with. We're not talking about those things that are matters of gospel obligation. We must do those to be right with God. But in those things that are matters of choice, matters of preference,
We must be willing to give up anything. Now, we may not struggle with eating of meats. Let's think about some of those things that we might struggle with. Think about attitudes. You know, it might be that I know that something is right, or I know that this is the way it ought to be, or I have this opinion, and I have the right to say that and declare it in whatever way that I want to. And I run right over you in the process. And I hinder you from doing those things that are right. I run over your feelings. I run over your attitudes. And I, as a result, turn you away from doing what's right. Am I right with God in the process? Absolutely not. Let's say with respect to clothing, you know, we live in an age in which we've got Madison Avenue telling men and women what they ought to wear. And they don't care what the Bible says. And it may be that something's very fashionable. Maybe that something looks very stylish. And it may be that we say, well, I've got the liberty to wear this. Brothers, whether we're talking about those shorts that we might wear, or sisters, whether we're talking about those dresses that might be low cut or might look like mini skirts in other kinds of circumstances, we don't need to be wearing those things because we must be willing to forego those kinds of things. The same thing is true whether we're talking about preferences, whether we're talking about feelings, whatever it might be. Now look over in Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9. You know, there are going to be those times in which we will offend. But may it be that when we offend, it is for the cause of Christ. And we're talking about the gospel is something that we must not bend. We must not give up for anyone. And if there is to be something that offends, something that someone doesn't like, or something that makes somebody turn in the other direction, may it be the Word of God that is that cause of offense. Look at what Romans chapter 9, verse 33 says as it describes Jesus and describes the very message of the gospel. As it is written, "Behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling stone and a rock of offense, and whoever believes on him will not be put to shame." Go back to Matthew chapter 18, and I'd like us to end by reminding ourselves of one last element of this passage. Matthew chapter 18. I want us to remember what Jesus describes as the consequence of this. We've got to take this seriously. We've got to always recognize that we influence those around us. We don't live in a vacuum. There are people who are watching us. There are people who are looking to us as an example, or looking to us, and our very influence upon them can either hinder them from doing right or help them do what's right. Our influence can either help them guard against sin or can tempt them and lead them to sin. Now, is it a big deal? What difference does it make, you might say? Remember what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 18 and verse 6. "But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea." I recognize sin is a personal choice. I recognize that ultimately even these little ones that are described there will stand before God for their individual choices that they make. But here Jesus focuses on the one who has influenced them to do that which is wrong. And notice he describes a pretty horrible kind of fate. I can't imagine what it would be like. You know, I'm not a very good swimmer, and the water scares me a little bit. I can keep myself afloat. But I can't imagine for a moment having a rope tied around my neck and the other end tied to a millstone, one of those huge grinding blocks, and thrown into the sea. The agony of that just is unimaginable to me. But Jesus says that would be better than having influenced others to sin, be cast into hell. That's the seriousness of what we're talking about. You know, there may be some here this morning that have never been obedient to the gospel of Jesus Christ. We haven't talked specifically this morning about that. But as we talk about the influence we have upon others, the point is that we must come to understand the seriousness of sin. Sin separates us from God. But thanks be to God, Jesus offered himself as a sacrifice on our behalf. That if in fact we will put our faith and obedience in Jesus, we will confess his name before men,
we will repent and turn away from sin and be baptized into Christ for the remission of sin, that sin need no longer separate us from God. If you're here this morning and you've never been obedient to the gospel of Jesus Christ, what better time could there be? We can help you. Won't you come? While we stand and sing.